Welcome back to the Book Club. I'm Michael Knowles, and on this episode, we will be reading Thomas Sowell, probably our most requested author on this entire show. We will be reading Race and Culture, two very controversial topics. But first, in our fast-paced world, it is tough to make reading a priority. Or at least it used to be. But at thinker.org, they summarize the key ideas from new and noteworthy nonfiction, giving you access to an entire library of great books in bite-sized form. You can read or listen to hundreds of titles in a matter of minutes, from old classics like Dale Carnegie's How to Win Friends and Influence People to recent bestsellers like Jordan Peterson's 12 Rules for Life. If you want to challenge your preconceptions, mezzo-mezzo, I don't know. If you want to expand your horizons, Or if you want to sound smart at cocktail parties, that's something we could all use. Go to thinker.org, that is thinkr.org, no E, no time for that. Start a free trial and put your mind in motion. All right, let's put our minds in motion. We have Race and Culture, A Worldview by Thomas Sowell, joined by the lovely Farah Jimenez, CEO of a nonprofit and chairman of Broaden Liberty. Farah, thank you for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
So, Farah, we have a rule on this show. All the authors have to be dead and gone, except sometimes there are some books that we want to read so badly that we kind of change the rules a little bit. So now we've changed the rules enough that you don't have to be dead, but you do have to be 90. We did Paul Johnson earlier on the show with Intellectuals, and now we've included Thomas Sowell. More people have requested Thomas Sowell on this show probably than any other author. Race and Culture, A Worldview. Highly controversial stuff. So much to get into here. So many opportunities for us both to be canceled and lose our careers. But before we do that, very briefly, can you just give us a quick summary? What is this book about?
So what Thomas Sowell is saying in Racism and Culture is that it's not racism or prejudice or hereditary in the environment that impacts what our socioeconomic differences amongst groups, that it's much broader and deeper than that. And that he defines that as culture is what creates the socioeconomic differences, and culture is how you view the world, your mindset, whether or not you embrace education, what work skills and work habits that you have. I think it's an exciting book because he's looking at it from the context of history. He's looking at slavery. He's looking at things that have impacted different racial groups. And then he makes the case that maybe it's not as straightforward that these factors are pushing against individuals and therefore causing them to struggle, but rather it's something innately within their capabilities that they can change and improve upon that can make the difference in their lives.
The reality is always so much more interesting than the little ideological one-sentence view. And Sowell certainly gets into those realities, some of which are very uncomfortable.
And I think one of the things that Sowell makes it really challenging to individuals to be willing to open themselves up to is the fact that he is saying that you can't blame others.
Yeah.
The circumstance that you find yourself in as a group, and sometimes as an individual, because not every individual within the group is necessarily living by values that make their life more challenging. But you can't necessarily blame others for the situation that you're in. You have ultimate power and control, and you need to find a way to exercise that power and control in order to succeed. I think it really speaks to much of my family's origin story, my parents being immigrants, being of color, they being able to succeed in life and instilling in me and my sister very clear values that are part of the argument that Thomas Sowell lays out in Race and Culture, which is that it's not necessarily racism and prejudice, heredity, environment, even politics that implicates and creates these socioeconomic divisions among groups. It's more about culture, and he defines culture as being mindsets, the way you view the world, the skills that you have, and even your work habits. And so that it's culture ultimately that makes the difference between those groups that succeed and those that lag behind others.
Because there is an idea here, especially in the United States, where we say, okay, the Italians are a certain way because of how American society acted on them. Black people are a certain way because of how American society acted on them. Jews are a certain way, right? And it goes on through every single race. But it's all about the environment. It's just about how a certain society has created these conditions. But what Thomas Sowell does here is he says, well, yeah, there's an environmental factor, But there are broader environmental factors that actually people, particularly if they've been transplanted from one place to another, and in the last 200 years we've seen more people move around the world than ever before in human history, you have other environmental factors that might have taken place 500 years ago or 1,000 years ago that shaped a people, and the people don't lose that culture just because they move from Sicily to America or from Kenya to America or wherever. So he's playing with all of these factors. I think the subtitle here is very important, which is we talk about worldview as though that's just your ideology or that's your perspective. But he's saying a worldview because he's looking all around the world. So he's looking at how these groups interact around the world to try to see, okay, what is just particular about America, but what is true of various groups elsewhere?
And you're absolutely right. That is one of the reasons that the book is so compelling, is that it's so easy to limit our thinking about what does race look like and culture look like within our domestic and more current contemporary world. But when you look at it over time, over hundreds of years, looking at slavery, looking at movements of people, looking at ascendance and then retrogression, and that can happen even in communities that at times have been at the very top in terms of success and then find themselves lagging behind others, either because they've moved or they've changed their mindset and their culture. Yeah. The other thing that's really interesting about it is he's looking at it from a world perspective and a global perspective. So the things that we tend to think of as just being uniquely American aren't necessarily true, that they are reflected around the world, that there are groups and subgroups that lag behind others because of the way that they exercise their culture.
You know, reading this book, I'm reading it now in our very politically correct culture where if you say anything out of order, you'll be canceled, your life will be ruined. And I think this guy is talking about race and IQ. He's talking about why certain races have done better at different periods of time. He's defending stereotypes in some places. And I think, how does Thomas Sowell get away with it?
Well, it helps that he's black.
It does help that he's black.
It does help that he's black. And it also helps that he himself was a child that was raised in poverty.
Yeah.
It helps that he himself was not raised by his mom or his dad, both one of whom died and one of whom gave him up to a great aunt to raise because she could not handle being a single mom of five children. And it helps that he got an education, both in a real education in terms of a special admission high school that he attended and ultimately finding his way to Harvard. But in addition, he got an education in the real world. And that's what led him from being a Marxist to being what he would call himself now, which is more of a libertarian and clearly informed by economics. I think what's also important about the book is what he's not saying. And I think that's what lets him say what he's saying.
Right.
You have to be willing to understand what he's not saying is that he's not saying that life is fair. Because if you trip yourself into believing life is fair, you're going to think the things that he's saying are really offensive and horrible. Mm-hmm. What he's not saying is that what is true for an entire group is necessarily true for every individual in that group. That certain groups lag behind because of their culture and their mindset doesn't mean that there aren't individuals within that group that have quality values, that have values of that have a different way of looking at the world and therefore have potential. And he's also not saying that we are purely economic actors, because you can look at it and say, oh gosh, you know, people aren't that focused on economics as to making their decisions. No, that's true. People are not. But it doesn't mean that economics still doesn't play a role in the way that we behave.
That is such a key point, because when you see something like race and culture, you think, okay, Thomas Sowell, I mean, he's this brilliant writer. As you say, he came from absolute nothing and, you know, he became one of the great thinkers of the last 50 years or so. But he's an economist. Why is an economist writing about race and culture? And it's interesting because he has this economic perspective, but he can also then see what is not an economic question. And I love on this fairness point, he writes it very clearly right in the middle of the book. He says, economics is a study of cause and effect, not intentions and hope. He's being very blunt here. He's saying, look, I don't think this is fair all the time. Actually, just before that, he quotes W.E.B. Du Bois, who is a sort of left-wing civil rights leader. He was a socialist. Du Bois writes in 1899, and this is Sowell repeating it, "The individual black workman is rated not by his own efficiency, but by the efficiency of a whole group of black fellow workmen, which may often be low. So some few would be promoted, some few would get new places, but this is if racial prejudices were to be dispensed with overnight. Some few would be promoted and everything, but the mass would remain as they are until a younger generation began to try harder, until the idle and discouraged were stimulated, and the whole race lost the omnipresent excuse for failure prejudice. Whoa, that is tough love from both Du Bois and from Sowell.
But it's also hope in that there's a recognition, because also Thomas Sowell would argue that characteristics of culture are not immutable, that they can change to the positive and they can change to the negative over time, as we've seen. Because around the time that W.E. Du Bois may have been writing this, there was a time where there was an ascendance in the African-American community, where individuals owned businesses, where there was a lot of quality education happening. Individuals were attending universities. My alma mater, University of Pennsylvania Law School, graduated one of the first African-American women from law school around that time. So this was happening, and there was this culture of, I'm going to succeed because it's important for me, but it's also important for my community to see this being emulated. Now, I think what's happened is that there is a culture that one would argue is not necessarily supporting people who want to strive, because we view that as being in conflict.
Right.
You're adopting, as when I was growing up, people would say you're trying to be white.
Yeah.
And what does that mean necessarily, right? It means that you're embracing a set of cultures and values that don't seem to be reflective of the community that you're supposed to be ascribed to.
That's right. There can be a social pressure not to succeed. And you know, one thing he takes great issue with is the idea of the legacy of slavery as being the reason for all sorts of pathologies among the American black community. And he says there are two sides to this. One is that this idea is kind of misused, not only by people trying to blame America and blame everybody, but also by people who are, I don't know, it's a white supremacist or something like that, who are anti-black racists. And both of them are wrong. Because what he points out is actually at the late 19th and early 20th century, black labor participation was higher than whites. Rates of marriage at certain points were higher than among whites. Then it all flips. And by the end of the 20th century, you see these crazy statistics where 3/4 of black children are born out of wedlock. And you know, partisans, on ideologues on both sides want to blame these sort of either biological factors or whatever, or the legacy of slavery. And he's saying, no, it's a little simpler than that, guys. You know, there's culture, and culture can change. And you can't go around blaming everybody for this. You should take discrete actions to fix it.
I don't know if it's simpler. It's interesting, because the way I look at it is actually harder. And the reason it's harder is because it requires an individual to act and to have the knowledge enough to act. It's harder than blaming the system.
You're right.
And blaming somebody else in the groups or the environment that you grew up in. It is much harder to recognize at that moment that maybe I didn't make the best choice, or maybe the choices that I made put me in a situation where my life's going to be harder. And one of the moments that was most spectacular for me was recognizing when I was working with women and children experiencing homelessness, how many of them did not recognize that they were making a choice by having more than one child out of wedlock. Mm. For them, it was life acting upon them, that they were controlled by their environment. And when those moments arose in them, when they recognized they could actually make a choice that was different, that they didn't have to have the fourth or the fifth, and in some cases, seventh baby out of wedlock, they would have that moment they realized, oh, that is a choice.
Huh.
And if I choose differently, I can actually position myself differently so that I can have success in my life. It was, those were the moments, and I'm not a crier where I would cry.
Yeah,
because you would
right.
recognize that awareness was going to make the difference in their life. They could respond, not react. They could do things of intention that would change their lives. And they weren't waiting for the entire system around them to change.
Right.
They knew that they could have the power to make that difference themselves. But it's hard to get people to go there because it feels judgmental. It feels judgmental to express that to someone when they've already made enough bad choices that maybe it's going to be harder for them to turn things around.
Right.
It feels judgmental to tell that to someone who, for whom that may be part of the culture, right?
Yeah.
They grew up in generations of single motherhood. And so how do you communicate that without judgment? But you say, these are choices, these are values, this is a mindset you can have that really does position you for success. And we see it all the time. We see it in the Thomas Sowell.
Yeah.
As an
right.
individual, we see it in the Condoleezza Rices of the world, right?
Yeah.
That they come from these experiences and they were taught and given the mindset that made it possible for them to make different choices that
right.
set them up for success.
And in some of his analysis, which you know you might say is a little cold or it's certainly not sentimental, it would seem that he's suggesting that actually by just looking at the facts and not sort of bemoaning the unfairness of the world, that is more compassionate to people. I mean, he gives the example of Italians and Irish fighting on the railroad lines. And I think I had ancestors on both sides of that particular battle, fighting while they were building the railroads. And you'd have, especially in the early wave of mass immigration to the U.S. in the early 20th century, late 19th century, you would have these groups of people that didn't work very well together. And so then you'd have a situation where employers would say, well, we're not going to hire the Irish. Irish need not apply. Now, there might have been individual Irishmen who were very good and stayed away from the whiskey and, you know, were perfectly amiable on the line. But there was an economic cost to even trying to sift through to find the right one, and there wouldn't be ethnic antagonisms on the line. And Soule basically says, look, that's just an economic fact, and it might be difficult for some period of time before these groups assimilate. But until then, you can't just go blaming everybody. You can't blame the employer because he wants to be able to make a profit and he's not willing to incur those costs.
And he's careful, Thomas Soule, to point out that, yes, that's the group dynamic, and it is uncomfortable and disappointing for the individual who might be that one Irishman who could have gone along well
yeah.
with the Italians working on the rails, right? But it doesn't negate the fact that as a system, because that's how economics works,
right.
it doesn't make economic sense for this employer to sift through all of those individuals to find the one that would make it work.
Right.
But what he also does is he goes further and he says the ability of the communities themselves then to do the sifting does give them economic benefit and power. So look at what happened in communities like Harlem,
yeah.
when you had Magic Johnson proclaim that he's going to start making investments in this community. This is when the crime started to dissipate a little bit. Harlem was not what it is today
yeah.
in terms of being socioeconomic diverse and really safe. It was a time where businesses didn't want to enter because they didn't know the population and they didn't know how to present themselves in a way that you were going to be able to make money, recognizing that crime was still very high and how people were going to make choices about where they were going to spend their money. And he proved that it could be really successful. And now we see how that community has turned around.
Right.
And I think that's one of the exciting things about Thomas Soule, is that he's saying, yes, the systems may not work, but as individuals and as groups, we can make things better for ourselves if we have the right perspective and mindset, what he calls culture.
Right. And yeah, and if people don't take this saccharine view of things, I mean, I love the example he gives of Sephardic and Ashkenazi Jews, right? Ashkenazi Jews are Eastern Europe and Sephardic are Spain and lived in Muslim lands and things like that. And he said, okay, to what degree can we attribute the success of these groups to genetics and to what degree to culture? And what he pointed out was, in various circumstances at different times in history, the Ashkenazi Jews did better than the Sephardic Jews, and then at other times, the Sephardic Jews did better than the Ashkenazi Jews. So you couldn't attribute it to some mere genetic circumstance, but you could attribute it to something going on within the group. There were real group dynamics here. And it seems to me that right now, if we even mention the idea that some group dynamic could be legitimate, that there could be group behaviors that are obviously not typical, that are not the case for every individual, but are typical over a general population, you will be thrown out of society. And Thomas Soule goes so far that he essentially says, stereotypes come from somewhere, and we have to understand them if we want to understand these people and perhaps even change behavior.
Yeah, and I think the reason people reject it is because we think of stereotypes only when they're negative. There are some positive stereotypes. My own family would tell us that when they came to the United States, that people were embracing their immigration because my family's from Cuba. And so the stereotype of the Cuban was hardworking, diligent, yeah. highly educated, didn't matter that they were black. Didn't manage that they were non-English speakers, and this was in the 1960s.
Right.
So the fact that they could come to the United States and people could ignore all the surface issues but recognized the values that they bring with them are such that we want to hire them. So my father, without a degree, was able to work as an engineer because he wasn't able to complete his education. My mom was able to open up a medical practice. All of that reflects that even stereotypes can be positive in nature.
Huh. You know, you're completely, like Thomas Soule does, you're completely smashing all of the narrative that we've been told, you know, from, I don't know, the 1619 Project or from other left-wing cultural institutions. But that is a pervasive narrative. I mean, we are now told that the country is viciously wicked, racist, bigoted, right down to its rotten core. It wasn't founded in 1776. It was founded in 1619. It wasn't founded in 1620 when the Mayflower landed. 1619 when the slaves hit our shores. And your family's experience does make me think, well, wait a second. If this country is so rotten, How? Why did your family come over? I mean, why do 2 million immigrants a year, by some measures, come over? Is there any way to counter this pervasive anti-American narrative? Is there any way to revise the revision of the history?
Well, it's so hard because a lot of it is around language and what and who is able to control how we use language. So I work in nonprofits, and one of the things that we are really successful at doing is deciding what words we want to use to influence funding and to influence the way people make it decisions about how to support the populations we support. So often we will say things like individuals are privileged, which means it's out of their control, or did they have an advantage, or did they have an opportunity, right? And so how do we use the words makes people feel that either it was in their control to make the difference in their lives or out of their control. And therefore somebody else needs to act on their behalf to make their life better. And I saw that a lot when I was working in poverty work, is that how often people felt like they were the ones who had to make it possible for someone else to succeed, as if you could instill education in someone else without their wanting to have it.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I find it's often the case. You just heard this from the 1619 Project lady. You heard it from Joe Biden. Joe Biden, running for president, he says, if you don't know if you're going to vote for me or not, you ain't black, which must be news to a lot of black people that the woman, Nicole Hannah-Jones, who runs the 1619 Project, she defended him. And she said, there's a difference between being physically black and being politically black, that there is a false consciousness, basically, if you're a black conservative. And people do this to Thomas Sowell or Candace Owens or to anybody else all of the time. There is a bit of an irony here that it's white liberals calling these black conservatives, you know, illegitimate and racist.
Well, generally it's because there's a political gain, and he does talk about that, where there's connection between race and politics, and that there are groups for whom, individuals for whom it's to their benefit to form groups that aren't natural in cohesion, but that allow for political power to exist.
Right.
And so one of the challenges often is if you're a different thinker, which is what I would consider myself, you struggle because people will say to you, well, you're not really black because you don't ascribe to these values, or you don't live by this culture, or you're not really Latina because you don't embrace some of the political ideology that some in the Latino community, as if Latinos were one group. They don't exist anywhere else in the world, right? There's such diversity within that community.
And even the term Latino is relatively recent. A lot of people don't identify with it.
There's no monolith in the Asian community. There's vast diversity. But people benefit by being able to put individuals into these groups. And so that's why I think you've got these movements, and that's why a Biden can say that you ain't black to black people, and for people not to be offended, because for them it's one way of getting people to agree that in order to be black, I should sign up and vote alongside and support these particular politicians and their worldview, even if it all the economics and all the research shows it's actually not benefiting me.
That's right. You know, it's so funny because I've had friends of mine who are white liberals come up and castigate me because I made some comment about, I don't know, history or something. As they'll say it's sexist or racist or whatever, and they'll be offended on behalf of other groups of people. But then my friends who were in the other groups, they like the content. They agree with it, but their opinion doesn't matter because the white liberal will have some offense on behalf of somebody else. And I thought, oh my gosh, how on earth have we gotten to this situation? And Sowell, at that back chapter, it's the final chapter of the book, Race and History, he quotes Edmund Burke, the great conservative philosopher. And Burke says, "In history, a great volume is unrolled for our instruction, drawing the materials of future wisdom from the past errors and infirmities of mankind. It may, in the perversion, serve for a magazine, furnishing offensive and defensive weapons and supplying the means of keeping alive or reviving dissensions and animosities and adding fuel to civil fury." And what Sowell adds to that in the first sentence is, history is not destiny. Do you see this sort of propagandization of history, that, you know, from one perspective, you can make history read anything you want it to read?
I think the thing I take away the most from his book is the fact that culture is not immutable. How we we can grow and we can embrace and be receptive to the way, and he talks about that because he talks about it too, in terms of culture being about receptivity. Yeah. When you look at it in the world, and that there are cultures that have been able to ascend in part because they've been willing to be receptive to the lessons that come from other groups. In my work, we call that code switching. And so what we teach a lot is that this idea that there are values that exist in your community, we totally get it. But if you want to ascend to the next socioeconomic level, and it's a hard and harsh reality, you're going to need to adopt the values of that socioeconomic class. And those tend to be different. It doesn't mean that there's lack of value in the way that we were raised. It doesn't mean that the people that make up your community are necessarily wrong. But if you have goals, there's a reason that this group is in this higher socioeconomic class. And what are those reasons? And what can you take away from them? Are you receptive to learn from them? And I have found that in the work that I've done in education, that those individuals who were raised by single moms or single dads or low-income families, whose parents said, watch that high net worth child, I'm going to send you to a school that's socioeconomically diverse because I want you to be surrounded by a culture where you're going to learn and be equipped with the skills and the mindset that's going to make it possible for you to be that kid who goes to Harvard Law.
To be successful.
To be successful.
Yeah. Right.
And they recognize that it's not going to happen by staying in their same group. It's only going to happen by them witnessing and being part of a community that's in a different place.
You know, this point on the code switching, it does make me think, when I think of some of my family, you know, in New York or friends in the Bronx, you know, who are a little more of that old world Italian mindset, you talk in a certain way, you behave in a certain way, conversations flow a certain way. There is often a different mindset. And then people who, you know, I don't know, they leave or they move somewhere else or whatever, the mindset starts to change, and this is a fear. I mean, this is the fear of that movie Get Out, actually, which I thought was a terrific movie, because the movie is about this fear of assimilation or adopting values of a class or of a group that, you know, you fear that you're losing your own identity.
And it makes you feel like you might be casting judgment on your family members and those who are part of your so-called tribe.
Yeah.
But in fact, what you're doing is you're opening yourself up to possibilities. And also, there's a reason those values exist. I remember once being part of a community where somebody was castigating a speaker because what he was suggesting is that the ideal scenario for a family is if there's a mother and a father in the household raising those children. And they responded by shouting them down, saying, how could you wish domestic abuse amongst women and for them to be enslaved in this marriage? And I remember thinking, too bad this guy doesn't know who this person is, because if I had been up on that stage, I would have said, and that's why you chose to be married before you had children. So then there are choices that individuals make for themselves, but they fear it's too judgmental to suggest that those should be the behaviors they should see in other people.
You know, my friend Andrew Clavin makes this point that the kind of liberal elite doesn't preach what it practices.
Oh, it is, yes. And that is one of the things often I would see in education, is that we've had controversies often where if we try and create equity in terms of access to the most selective public high schools, that people will respond in a negative way, even if it's as subtle as deciding on one day that everybody in the community can apply to a selective high school. Why? Because it ups the chances that their own children may not have that opportunity. Mm. And so what they're trying to fight is the fact that when you create a pathway that makes it really accessible for all, you're making it less likely that you who have the advantage and the knowledge and the relationships might be able to benefit most highly. And that is not race.
You're right.
That is
You're
socioeconomic advantages. And so I think that one of the things that he's saying is that it's really important for people who are come from cultures who are of a particular group where their culture is not providing them those kinds of advantages, that they need to embrace them. And I would think one of the things I would challenge, although he is 90, so I don't know how many more books he has in him, but
hopefully
I would be really
hopefully he's got many books left.
I would be really interested in his take on not just culture in terms of race-based culture, right, culture that comes from that group, but socioeconomic culture.
Right.
Because there's such diversity.
Yeah.
And it doesn't require you to be tied to your race. It can be tied to your socioeconomic place.
And when he's delving these questions, he is saying things that, you know, would cancel a lesser man. You know, I mean, he's raising real issues. pointing out when he talks about slavery, he says, like, every group in history has been enslaved. And actually, in the case of the Britons, when the Romans went to capture them, Cicero told the Romans, he said, don't bring the Britons back to be slaves. They're too stupid to be slaves. Leave them up in Britannia, you know, come back, get better slaves here. But, you know, all of these groups, even the word slave, right, comes from the Slavs.
Yeah.
And so slavery has been practiced in many places. It is still practiced today in other places. And he's saying things that are just very, very uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
But it's because he's not afraid of the facts. He's not afraid of the answers. He thinks, actually, knowledge is a good thing, and it will help all of these groups get along better and rise up in the world.
And he also challenges our political actors to embrace facts, to inform the way that they put together their strategies and their solutions. It's so easy to go on symbolism.
Yeah.
So we look at things today like defund the police, right? So it feels incredibly empathic to be supportive of individuals who are coming out of prison.
Mm-hmm.
And I get it, and wanting to address that in criminal reform is important. But defunding the police, what it does is it creates economic instability in communities that most need the police in order to create systems where businesses can thrive and produce. And so those communities that are hard hit are usually the communities where the lagging groups are residing. So when
and
you
he,
see
he
that.
He touches on that
right,
actually
exactly.
as well, all those years ago.
Right. And the book is now 26 years old, and you think about it, right? It's still completely applicable, some of these ideas that he puts forth.
Right.
So I think our political actors are looking for the things that feel immediate as a solution, but aren't necessarily the things that are going to make the long-term difference in the lives of people.
Right, and everyone's walking around eggshells, in particular on these two issues, on race and culture. They're so afraid. And Sol tells us, don't be afraid of the facts. Embrace the facts. It's okay. That is the only way that we will move forward, which is a hopeful view in the end.
Yes.
We can embrace the facts by reading this book, by the way. Farah, thank you so much for being here. Where can people find you?
Oh, I guess they can find me on Twitter at Farah M. Jimenez.
Farah M. Jimenez. They can find you on Twitter there until we get canceled for this terribly politically incorrect episode. But thank you so much. What a wonderful book and a wonderful discussion to work through these issues. I suppose we'll be canceled next time. But if not, you can find us here again. I'm Michael Knowles. This is The Book Club. Thank you so much for watching this episode of The Book Club on PragerU. PragerU is a 501c3 nonprofit organization, so we rely on donations from viewers like you to keep this content on the air. Please consider making a tax-deductible contribution today to help keep this content coming. Thank you very much.